Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
Now you are welcome along to the football show. These are interesting times in the world of football. We will, by the way, bring you live commentary of Manchester United against Liverpool on Sunday from Old Trafford, just to mark your card if you're wondering about that game. In the meantime, tomorrow night on the show, Dan McDonald will be in studio. Wednesday evening is a Champions League evening. Very happy to say Kenny Cunningham, the man himself, will be in studio for the night. It's the first time since pre-March 2020 that has happened. So we're really looking forward to having Kenny in for the evening. Thursday, John Giles with Nathan. And then Robbie Fowler is coming up next week. We have a Cadbury Roadshow next week. Robbie Fowler, the main guest. And over the weekend just gone, John Duggan was chatting to Peter Schmeichel. Jer had Brian McClair on Friday. Very interesting character. So actually, not a bad lineup when you list it all off like that. And of course, Damien Delaney is with us now. Hello.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Most importantly, Damien Delaney is with us now. You're keeping well. You enjoyed the football over the weekend. What caught your attention? What matches were you watching?
Yeah, I did. I really enjoyed it, actually. I watched a lot of games. I watched a lot of highlights of games as well. I watched the Everton game yesterday, which probably was a bad choice. It wasn't the most amazing of games, but nonetheless, I enjoyed all the games. I enjoyed watching all the subplots unfolding, really, as the season's wearing on. It's starting to take shape now. Die has been cast, and it's very, very hard to change now once you start getting moving in the season. So just watching all teams unfold is pretty good.
Well, subplot's probably an understatement for what's going on at St. James's Park. It was very much the story of yesterday and probably has been the story of the last week or so. We saw Amanda Staveley in the sand. We saw Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the new Newcastle chairman, governor of the Public Investment Fund. We saw Anton Deck. All the stars were out, you know. This was a big occasion at St. James's Park. And Spurs promptly came and beat Newcastle 3-2. And Newcastle are very much in a relegation fight now. They're on 3 points. They're in 19th. They are three from safety. So a reminder, lest it was needed, that for all the money and for all the excitement, in the short term, very little is going to change. This will depend on what they do in January, obviously. But Newcastle, how much of a relegation fight do you think they have on their hands? I know lots of people would love them to get relegated for just the sheer hilarity of it all this season.
Yeah, it would be great to see them in the championship, see what they could attract, how many players would be willing to go there. But I think the next few weeks is going to be vitally important for them, because if they get cut adrift or they leave themselves with too much to make up, all the signings in the world could find it difficult in a relegation battle and the pressure that would come with. Listen, by the way, I don't think Newcastle are going to get relegated, but I just think that if they did kind of fall apart between now and January before the reinforcements can come in and they find themselves maybe 5 or 6 points adrift, which is very, very possible, then they could find life very, very awkward indeed, because obviously the expectant media, crowd, everybody is just watching Newcastle, and if there's 5 or 6 points adrift, it might be difficult for them to make them up. I'm pretty sure they will. I don't imagine Steve Bruce lasting a whole pile longer in the job for the very reason I just stated. It's not a risk that they want to take or they can take. So how that unfolds in the next few weeks will be really, really interesting.
To put the money we're talking about here into some kind of context, so the Saudi PIF, the Public Investment Fund, is worth 320 billion sterling, which is 14 times more than the Manchester City owners. So to say money here is no object is an understatement. This is going to be serious. But I did want to get your thoughts on the footballing aspect of this. The more controversial aspect has been well discussed. You mentioned there you don't think Steve Bruce will last much longer. I would think a lot of the players wouldn't expect to now last a particularly long time at Newcastle. This is a weird atmosphere, I would think, to be a part of. Lame duck manager is complicated at the best of times, and now you have a dressing room who just hear the clock ticking. I will be replaced by someone either in January or in summer, or certainly by the following January if they can do it.
Yeah.
That's a really hard dynamic to try and build some kind of sense of involvement and camaraderie, and we're in this together and we're working towards something. I can imagine the arse falling out of the atmosphere in that dressing room very quickly.
Yes, that is very, very possible. But I think from a player's point of view, I was involved in something similar, not on the same scale, when I was at QPR and I signed, and you know, the Mittal family and Briatore and Bernie Eccleston bought, you know, and then they signed. I was one of the 12 players that they signed in the January, and we all just arrived and we'd all been given, you know, new bumper contracts, and it was a great atmosphere to be involved in. And I do remember a lot of the players that were there who kind of were being ushered out. It can be very, very difficult. So speed is going to be crucial for these guys. Now, they're going to have to make a statement sooner or later in terms of a statement of intent with what they do, because expectancy is through the roof and they want to utilise that. They want to use it and ride that kind of wave of optimism that's around the place. And that's where I think that Steve Bruce won't be around much longer. I like Steve Bruce. I think he's done a pretty good job in difficult situation. This is not a slight on Steve Bruce one way or another. It really isn't. I'm pretty sure if Steve Bruce had more funds or could maybe operate a little bit differently, maybe he could have got more of the squad. But I think he's done enough at Newcastle there to warrant getting another Premier League job. And I suppose the good thing is for him, from his point of view, is he's going to get paid up in full. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when they do decide to pick a manager, Steve Bruce could quite easily say, well, I want every penny of what my contract is. And the owners won't want to delay. They won't want to enter into any negotiations with him. More than likely, they're just going to give him every penny just to move him on, as I said, because there is a time kind of pressure with Newcastle at the moment. And January is going to be very, very similar. Now, if I was a player in Newcastle, my mind would be thinking kind of one of three ways, really. I suppose the first way would be, well, we're all going to get, you know, sold or moved on or training with the under-21s when they sign 10, 11 players over the next 12 months. But as a player, you're going to be thinking, well, I'm going to get paid up my contract as well. You know, I'm going to get every cent. If they don't want me, they're going to have to pay me up to move me on. And it might mean some of them have to go back to the Championship. But look, from a financial point of view, if you're a player at Newcastle, no, it's not going to be the end of the world. You know, from a playing point of view, some of them might be have done enough or be good enough to continue playing in the Premier League or get another Premier League club. But some, if not, you know, definitely go all the way to the Championship. But they're going to go there with some big checks really in their back pocket. And the third way of thinking about it really is I might get to be a part of this. You know, Callum Wilson will almost certainly be thinking, if I can keep scoring goals, they're going to need four centre forwards. They're not going to sign four centre forwards in the next 12 months. And if I'm part of it, I can kind of piggyback the wage structure, which is going to explode in the next few months. So there are certain players there who are of a pretty good level. You know, Lascelles is a decent player. I know that John Joe Shelby's played at a top four club before as well at Liverpool. He's a decent player. Callum Wilson, you know, so they'll all be thinking, can we ride this as well? So I don't think it'll be as down and out and dour as what you think it is. I think it's going to be a really exciting time.
Interesting. Well, I did read Steve Bruce will be in line for about 10 million sterling. So
there you go.
That softens the blow. There's no
doubt. Absolutely.
That softens
the
blow.
And his CV means he's going to get a job tomorrow if he did get sacked today.
On the players you mentioned there who may be approached and told, well, there's not a place for you here anymore, you were saying they can get their contracts paid up in full. How does that tend to work? I guess the options for the club are, one, we approach the player and we say, yeah, look, you've 2-3 years left here. We don't see you as being part of the plans.
Yeah.
You're owed X. Can we meet you halfway? And the player will presumably say, no, you're paying me every cent or every penny. And so the club might do that. Is it in the club's interest to just keep a player around for 2-3 years rotting in the reserves? Do you think they will approach a lot of players and pay them off?
Yeah, absolutely. They won't pay them off, but what they'll do is they'll actively be trying to move certain players on now. So they will be saying, well, if a new manager comes in, he'll have a list of players I want to keep, players I want to get out. And the players that are going to be wanted to be moved on are going to be toted around to other clubs. And those players will get offers to go elsewhere. And then obviously the player would say, well, I can go to Club X, but I need you to pay me X amount of money to go. So the players could essentially double up their money because they could get a full payout of their contract from Newcastle and then get paid again the same amount of money at the new club they're at. So it can be quite a lucrative position that a lot of players find themselves in when they get moved on. So the clubs will try to negotiate, but again, they're not going to want an under-23s or a training ground packed with maybe 10, 11, 12 players that have been told to move on, because that will obviously influence the atmosphere. So the club will try to negotiate with them, but in the interest of, you know, expediency, they will probably just cut them all big checks and move them on down the road. If and it is a minor if or a major if, depending, they do go and spend the type of money that everyone thinks they're going to spend in January.
As for those players who you said might be part of it, you said the wage structure is about to explode, which I'm sure it is. So say you're a Callum Wilson and you're his agent. He might have 4 or 5 years left on a deal. I don't know the situation, but just take that in theory. Does agent then go to club and say, hey, things have changed here, we need to renegotiate my player's contract, you're doubling his wages because everyone else around him in that dressing room was on X? Will the club be receptive to that, do you think?
Possibly, absolutely. But I mean, they might not even necessarily say we're going to double it, because I mean, let's say the certain wage structure is a certain amount of money and other players come in on 5 times that money, then the agent won't be saying, well, I want to be up with the new stars and the wage bill that's there. But like, you need to give my guy a little bump. But a little bump in the vicinity of the top guys is incredible. And someone like Callum Wilson, who will and can and will score goals, and you need a 25-man squad, and it's going to be a number of years before Newcastle have 25 world-class players similar to Manchester City. I mean, you just need to look at what happened there when they took over. They signed Rubinho straight away as a statement of intent. So this Newcastle thing isn't going to explode overnight. You know, they probably, will just maintain their Premier League status this year. They'll boost with maybe 2 or 3 players in January. They'll do another 2 or 3 or 4, 5 possibly in the summer, and then have a cut-off top four. But I mean, you know, the season after next, will they make the Champions League? Possibly, but it's maybe 3 seasons down the line before we really start seeing it, because it is difficult time-wise to instigate the change that we're talking about. It won't just happen overnight.
Yeah, there was a piece yesterday in the Sunday Times with Mark Hughes and his assistant at the time of the Man City takeover, and the owners called him in advance of the Rubinho signing and were making the point that it was either going to be Rubinho or Ribery, and they got Rubinho, and you kind of think Ribery might have been a better option there the way things played out. They were also saying it was extraordinary behind the scenes. You know, Mark Hughes had half mentioned to the new owners that the training ground was only so-so, and at the very first international window, everybody was told, well, don't come near the place for 10 days. And when they all arrived back, the training ground had been completely done up and remodeled and took all their breath away. So from the off, money was just being thrown everywhere. You were one of those 12, you said, that went to QPR in January.
Yeah.
Was there resentment when all you boys pitched up from the mainstays in the dressing room?
No, not at all. All those lads were good as gold. I mean, that's the thing about football, is they understand that it's not my fault. You know, it's not anybody's fault. The owners have done what they've done, and they've signed 12 players.
You didn't need to drive into the training ground in a red Ferrari.
Not quite, no. But the lads that were there, as I said, got moved on over time.
Okay.
And I'd say in the space of like a year, the squad had completely changed. I mean, there was one or two guys, like Martin Rowlands, who was QPR. He actually played for Ireland back in the day under Trapattoni. He was QPR, born and bred, and he was captain at the time. And he managed to get kept on. But I remember then, like, that when they said they were keeping him, his contract got altered to kind of be brought in line with everybody else's, because you can't have a captain on a certain wage when everybody is brought in is on a certain other wage. Mm. Now, the scale of Newcastle is obviously incredibly different, but the mechanics of what's happened is very, very similar.
Yeah. And what was it like being in a dressing room where there was so much change? Did it feel less bonded than, say, the Palace dressing room when you had a bit of a groove going?
Yeah, it's very difficult when you get 12 players coming in from all over the place. It's very, very difficult to settle. There was an Italian manager there, a guy called Luigi Di Canio. I think he knew he was probably going to get fired at one stage, and the atmosphere got very, very strange. But we were all enjoying ourselves. The football we played was great. We done really, really well. We ended up finishing mid-table that year. But then they changed the manager, and then obviously the owners were extremely impatient and they wanted success straight away. And they couldn't understand that they went out and bought so many players, and players who had experience of getting promoted to the Premier League before. Why weren't we top of the league by 5 points after like 5 games? You know, that type of carry on. I mean, Ian Dowie got sacked and we were 7th, I think, 2 points off the playoffs after 5 or 6 games. So that type of stuff happened. And then there was an upheaval. Another manager came in and he got sacked. And then the whole thing got very, very strange. And it was only kind of after I left that Neil Warnock came in and managed to get a handle on it. But by then, I think the club had changed hands anyway. So it can get messy if it's not done right. And you need the right people in the right positions to make the right decisions.
Yeah, I'll bet. So Graeme Souness, by the way, was writing yesterday in the Sunday Times, and he made a suggestion where initially I thought, ah, no, we just can't do this. But then the more I thought about it, there might be something in the idea. He was suggesting moving the training ground to London as a way of getting bigger name players there. Now, I think from a PR point of view, they could never come out and move the training ground to London. However, they could come out and say, we are building a second training ground in London. It makes sense, and you know, it'll reduce travel and for certain parts of the season. And then I'm sure it'll turn out in 2 years' time they've spent about 4 days in the Newcastle one and the rest of the time in the London training ground. Look, it wouldn't be popular with fans, and in some kind of grim way it would really copper fasten just how dislocated clubs are now. They're just bought by foreign owners and have very little relationship to the area. But as soon as was getting at something, they will struggle to attract real top line players to Newcastle in the short term. Like, there's going to be this phase of dud signings, I would think, where there will be a period, these super talented players, I think...
Is that what it was at QPR, Joe?
Precisely. I'm talking about... I want you to picture the Damien Delaney types at QPR here. That's exactly what I have in mind. But there will be a type of player, right, that I would be suspicious of, whereby they could go elsewhere and they might prefer to go elsewhere, but the money will sway them to go to Newcastle, and Newcastle will pay this premium to get them up north and less glamorous and all the rest of it. I don't know about those types of players, that kind of just below top tier where there's a mercenary quality. And I know all players are mercenary to some extent, but I think there are going to be dud signings along the way, and the Newcastle aspect as opposed to, say, a London club will come into play here a little bit as well. Give us your sense of that, because you'd have a feel for how footballers think and talk.
I think initially, yes, because although the financial side of it would be great, there will be a big issue with regard to getting players to move to Newcastle. And the project and success and having Champions League football will play a bigger part. If Newcastle are playing in the Champions League and the kind of money that we're talking about is on offer, you won't have a problem getting players to go to Newcastle. The problem is going there while it's in its bedding in phase or in its infancy or it's having its teething problems. That's the issue that they'll really struggle with. When the project is nearer completion and they have a new training ground, the stadium's been upgraded, there are regulars in the Champions League, they're competitive for the Premier League, you won't have an issue getting players to Newcastle. Initially, you might do, but I take your point, but you're right. To get the real elite up-and-coming Erling Haalands, you might struggle because... You know, there's going to be a bedding in or an infancy kind of period where it's going to be difficult. But in the long run, it won't matter. The money's going to be paid and the project's going to be on offer. So that idea of moving to the training ground to London is off the wall and is a non-runner from the start. And I didn't see it, so I'd be reluctant to comment on Graeme Souness's
He meant it. He said, I know this sounds crazy, but actually, as a way of selling the place to a Spanish player and his girlfriend, London training ground is the way to go. I mean, I'm not misrepresenting him.
So you expect the fans of Newcastle to show up, cheer, support on a Saturday afternoon at St. James's Park, knowing that the only reason they got this guy is because he could live in London. I mean, that's not ever going to work. That's an insane idea. I mean, he said it was crazy. He knows it's crazy. Maybe he said that tongue-in-cheek. I'm not sure. But that is, I mean, the biggest non-runner I've ever come across in my life.
Well, I hope these same fans aren't deluded enough to think that the player is pitching up at Newcastle because they really feel something about the city. I mean, it's all about money anyway, so let's be grown up about this. All the Newcastle fans turned up at St. James's with tea towels around their heads. You know,
there's a charade that's why they're coming.
Okay.
But if they go to London, I think that charade is well and truly...
It's harder for the charade. Yeah. God, there's something grim about that, isn't there?
The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
For me, footwork has been something that's got me out of trouble on more than one occasion on and off the pitch, so I'll go with that one.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Now, you're welcome back. Joe Malloy here. Damien Delaney with me on the football show this evening. So we've talked Newcastle. Manchester United play Liverpool this Sunday. We have commentary here on Off the Ball. Manchester United going into this game, 4 defeats in 7, lost to Leicester 4-2. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was chatting after the game, and I think you can sense here there's a backs to the wall quality about how he's feeling. And just listen out. I mean, even he's conceding there's something off with the balance in this team. Here's Solskjaer after that 4-2 defeat.
Over the international break, we've had a good time to to see what's gone wrong lately, because one result in isolation, it can be look, margins, but then we've got too many games now that we've lost points, so we need to look at the whole setup of the team, whole balance of the team. Maybe something has to give.
Is it a bit of a wake up call?
Shouldn't be, because we've had wake up calls before. So every game, every point in the Premier League, you've got to fight for. You've got to win second balls. You've got to tackle. You've got to block. You've got to win headers. And in key moments today, we just didn't block or defend well enough or even attack well enough.
Atalanta next to get it out of the system. They will presumably play a similar way to Leicester. It'll be pretty fast and furious.
It's fast and furious, and every game's a test of character here. Especially now, it's an examination of character, staff, players, everyone around here, that we stick together and fight on Wednesday night.
Now, this is starting to come apart a little bit for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. The team, if anyone didn't catch it, Wan-Bissaka, Lindelof was in. There was no Varane. It was Lindelof, Maguire, Shaw, Pogba and Matic as their two midfielders. Greenwood, Bruno, Fernandes and Sancho, and then Ronaldo leading the line. Expand on what you think he's talking about there when he says balance. Like he was alluding to a lack of work rate and a lack of tackling and a lot of the basics not happening. When he says balance, what I interpret that as is an acknowledgement that Ronaldo's not going to do much work, and so how many more passengers can we have, i.e. the likes of Pogba not doing too much work. It sounded to me like someone who's thinking of hooking some big players very, very soon.
He won't do that. There's no way he'll do that. That would be that would only just fast forward the decision an awful lot if he starts doing that. Look, I'm not going to criticise Man United, because there's no need to know. It's self-evident of what we're watching. He's not the guy. I've been saying it for the best part of 15 or 16 months. He's just not the guy. I think there's a complete and utter lack of cohesion in Manchester United. There's a lack of discipline. And I think that stems massively from the manager, because the manager is the one who sets the standards, the one manager who ultimately holds people accountable. And if you don't run back, there has to be consequences. If you don't get into shape, you have to be held accountable. Now, if the manager is not giving those instructions, then it's his fault. If he is giving him those instructions and they're not doing it, it's still his fault. The gaps in the team are incredible. Like the back four, Harry Maguire always drops off and it creates a huge pot of space in front of the back four and behind the midfield players. It's very, very difficult to be a midfield player for Manchester United. I'm kind of going to go off on a little kind of odd one now. And I feel sorry for Fred. He's not a fantastic player. I'm not defending him in any way, shape or form. But he's put in some awful situations. I know he didn't play on Saturday against Leicester. It was Matic. But it's the same thing. The gap behind them versus the gap in front of them is too big. So you've got the likes of Bruno, who is a free spirit. He just does what he wants. He does no responsibility on him. He's basically told on the pitch, go and enjoy himself, join in, track back if you want to track back, do what you want to do. So the space the midfield players have to cover is far, far too big. And all that stems from Harry Maguire dropping off, because that's what he does. He hasn't got the mobility to hold a high line up the pitch. So if you can keep a high line, right, and condense the space, the midfield players then only have to worry about the space in front of them. Then they don't have to worry about behind them. But too often, Manchester United get caught in behind that midfield and the back four. So that's what he's talking about, with balance. And the reason he plays two central midfield players in Fred and McTominay, because that's his go-to one, is because two players defensively can fill that space. Mm. As soon as you go with one, and especially when one of the two is Pogba, who's a bit of a joiner-inner as well, doesn't really think defensively when they have the ball. He's not thinking, if we lose this, how are we looking? So it's very, very difficult for one number six to cover the amount of ground that's been asked to cover. The back four need to hold a higher line. When they signed Varane, everybody thought that Varane was going to be the one that would help United hold that high line. His pace would help cover round. But it's not going to happen, because Harry Maguire's instincts, his natural instinct, is to drop off. When he's asked a question, insofar as when he's in space, he'll drop off and it creates problems. That's almost like, if you ever held a bag of sand up and stuck a knife in the bottom of a bag of sand, all the sand empties out the bottom. That's what it's like when Harry Maguire drops off. The whole team almost just gets sucked backwards and the spaces then are too, too big. Bruno doesn't get back into defensive shape often enough. And the two centre midfield players, and he's going to go back to that as sure as anything. I know he's going to, if Fred and McTominay are available, he's going to go back to the two of those because it's his best chance. It's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be nice. It's going to be soak up pressure, counter-attack, but it's going to be stuff that got them results in the big games, the 0-0s last year that they got, the couple of 1-0 wins they got in big games last year, because the job's on the line now. And he's tried to open up and go one defensive midfield player, but they just haven't got the personnel to do it.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't work. And, I mean, as you said, especially when Pogba's one of those two, like he makes these very theatrical attempts to tackle. He like plants his foot. He puts himself out of the game deliberately. He did it a few times and Leicester got shots away, as opposed to a really kind of honest player would jockey and stay with the opponent and try and get a block in. And Pogba puts himself out of the game. He almost says, well, I've tried. And it's very theatrical, yeah. And then they're in on the back four. So,
but I see both sides. Just it's very hard for him though. When I mean, there's nothing more soul destroying for any midfield player. Ask any midfielder played at a good level. When a ball gets passed down the side of them, they spin their head round and they see the two centre backs 25 yards away.
No, I get that as well. Let's go to that core problem then. How slow is Maguire? Is he correct for his own sake, for instance, to drop back a little bit? Like if Maguire plays a high line, are Manchester United goosed against Premier League pace?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and, so he has to drop then?
He has to, yes.
Okay.
But he takes the whole team with it.
So what's the solution then? Is there no way that they can say, look, they're not going to say this as explicitly as this in the dressing room. Harry's going to drop deep because Harry's not very fast. Therefore, we all need to be compact and move up and down as a unit a bit more. Yeah. How can, I mean, teams can sit very deep and be compact and they get away with it. Why do Manchester United have each line so far apart from each other?
Because it's very rare you find teams play with wingers now, chalk on the hill wingers, and Manchester United do. So now you've got Sancho on the left touchline, 25 yards, 30 yards to Ronaldo, then another 25, 30 yards to Greenwood. Right. Then in the middle of all that, you've got Bruno, who just floats around and does what he wants. It's very, very, very spread out. So when you win the ball back against Manchester United, there's lots of space. And the two midfield players, or the one midfield player in Fred and, let's say, you know, Matic and Pogba for the sake of the game on Saturday, all of a sudden now have three players that are spread out over 60, 70 yards in front of them. Bruno, no one really knows where he is or where he's going to be. And then you turn around and you got your back four or 25 yards behind him. That is a vast amount of space.
Yeah.
An incredible amount of space for anybody to cover.
Yeah.
So, I mean, ultimately, he said he's gone on record before saying he wants to play wingers because, you know, that's the Manchester United way. But I think a way that will go to alleviate that is tuck the wide players in. You know, ask Bruno to be a little bit more defensively, put restrictions on him. You have to demand that of him though. That's the accountability that I'm talking about. That he can't just go where he wants. He needs to play within a structure. He has to. And then you might be able to get away with a little bit more compact because the wide players are a little bit narrower. Then you'll get away with Ronaldo not running because right at the minute now it's being shown up so much because he's standing in oceans of space and he's not running because he doesn't want to run. At every other club or Portugal, he's got players around him that will do his running for him. So make the pitch smaller when you're out of possession. That would be, for me, the number one thing. Now, the back four, this is why Liverpool can counter-press so well. It's because the back four on the halfway line, and now you're just pressing in half a pitch.
Yeah.
And the ball, we spoke about this before, the ball over the top is the only out ball you have against Liverpool. That's very, very difficult to do. Every team, every world-class team now holds a high line. From Bayern Munich to Man City to Liverpool, all of them do it.
Mm. There's quite a few problems there to sort out by Wednesday and then Sunday against Liverpool. Like, that's fairly significant surgery on the way they've been playing for 18 months.
Yeah, absolutely. But the reason he got away with it last year is because he stuck with the Fred McTominay partnership.
Yeah.
And that limits the damage. And Manchester United are a team packed with world-class players. And if you can be defensively solid, Bruno's going to get your goal. Cristiano's going to get in a goal. You know, Greenwood's going to get your goal. They have goals in them. Mm. The problem is they keep conceding or they keep giving up large portions of games. So he's going to go back. I can guarantee you, he's going to go back to two defensive midfield players. That's the balance that he's talking about. And he's going to go back to counter-attacking. And he's going to almost stick two fingers up to everyone and go, I don't care what it looks like. I'm going to lose my job very, very soon unless I can get some results. Results are the only thing that can keep people off my back at the moment. And by hook or by crook, I'm going to get them. And I don't care what the aesthetics look like.
And these very significant problems that you're talking about, exacerbated then by the stupid goals they're giving away as well. Like Harry Maguire waiting for a bus, I was going to say, that pass to him. And then, you know, the set piece concessions as well. If they're that open in general play, they can't afford to be giving away these stupid goals either. Yeah. So it's one problem on top of another right now.
But I think that those problems are a symptom of the underlying issues. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world, and every manager has said it, and it's the most used excuse. Oh, we're giving away silly goals. Mm. If you're giving away silly goals every week, it's not like individual mistakes. If you're giving two or three every week, there's some fundamental underlying issues that are forcing players into making these mistakes. Yeah. You know, that there's a lack of confidence. They don't feel comfortable. Harry Maguire obviously has his issues with injury. Maybe he shouldn't have played the game. But again, that's the manager's decision. He picked him and he got that one wrong. But look, that's enough. Look, everyone knows how I feel about that. But what I would say is that, like, from a positive point of view, is it's salvageable for Manchester United. We're only in October. They're only 4 or 5 points off it. They're still in the Champions League. But if they wait any longer, I mean, their season, you know, in the next 3-4 weeks, they could be out of the Premier League because they're going to be so far adrift, they're never going to get it back. And they could be out of the Champions League, or they could finish second and get a tough draw. I mean, if they fixed it now and they were like, I mean, if they were as ruthless as Roman Abramovich, they just pull the trigger and get it done now and salvage the season. And that's what he did last year with Frank Lampard, and Chelsea got something out of the season. Yeah. If they drag their heels and they wait, it's not going to change. It's been 4 years and it's the same stuff. That is not the very definition of insanity, Joe? Doing the same stuff over and over again, expecting different results? It's not going to change. The die is cast. The only way it's going to change is if somebody makes a change. And I think another manager can get an awful lot more out of the squad. Mm. And I just hope, for Manchester United's sake, that they pull the trigger and get on with their season.
So Liverpool come into town then on Sunday at Old Trafford. 5-0 win at the weekend against Claudio Ranieri's Watford. Mo Salah is in form of life territory. To be fair to him, he's been in pretty amazing form for a long time now. 29 years of age, I wanted to ask you about this notion of a late developer, because at 20 or 21, Salah was not destined for this level of greatness. Jurgen Klopp said after the game, he's probably the best player in the world right now in current form. And just, I was reminding myself of his career. So 29 years of age, his first move to Europe was to Basel. Chelsea bought him for, it was 11 million. In 2014, when he was 22 years of age. So clearly he's catching the eye, 22, 11 million. I mean, we're not talking about a complete dud here. But his debut season used very sparingly 10 Premier League games across 2013-14. I don't know if you remember coming across him then. 3 Premier League games the following season. And then he goes on loan to Fiorentina, goes on loan to Roma. 15-16, he scores 15 goals for Roma and gets a permanent move there for £15 million. And then the following year, they finished second in Serie A and he scores 19 goals. So Liverpool, on the back of his 19 goals in Serie A, buy him for, in fairness, club record 37 million. But I don't think anyone expected him to take off the way he has. And straight away, that first season, 32 goals in 36 Premier League games. Golden Boot, PFA Players Player of the Year. He comes third in the Ballon d'Or. And then 2019, joint top Premier League scorer again, wins the Champions League. 2020, they win the Premier League. He scores 23 goals in all competitions. And even last season, Liverpool's form obviously was horrible. But Salah still managed 31 goals in all competitions. And now here we are. He's aged 29 and he's got 10 goals in 10 games, 7 in 8 Premier League games, and just seems to be off the charts. I don't think when he pitched up at Chelsea and was 23 and then 24 and then went off to Italy on loan, even allowing for Chelsea being difficult for certain young players, Kevin De Bruyne jumps to mind. I don't think anyone saw him coming back like this and doing what he's done in English football. So this notion of the late developer is a really interesting one in football and how certain players blossom at certain stages.
Yeah, it's also a kind of a nod that not everybody's a child prodigy. You know, there are child prodigies out there and people are destined for greatness from a very, very young age. But also, players can learn and get better, and that's what he's proven. I mean, he was obviously talented. That's why he got that move to Basel, and then obviously done well enough there. Somebody saw something in him, and everybody hopes that he'll develop to the level that he has developed to. But he's learned, and he's got better and better and better, and he's 29 years of age now, and I would agree with Jurgen Klopp that he right now he is the best player in the world. I mean, he is in the form of his life, and he's making it extremely difficult for Liverpool to sell him or let him go. Because I know Liverpool don't want to give him the type of contract that would reflect his status as the best player in the world, because that's probably the last thing Liverpool want to do to break a wage structure. But I tell you, he's making it very, very, very difficult. The board every day are thinking, OK, we might have to do this, and that's going to bring a whole host of problems further down the line. So listen, I'm delighted for him. He's a fabulous player. He's in the form of his life, and it's a joy to watch him every week.
His agent arrived into England over the weekend, presumably for talks, and presumably to say, fellas, 500 grand a week, take it or leave it. So that will be interesting. I don't know if you remember coming up against him at Chelsea all or not. But
no, never do. No.
Any players that you played with surprise you? Because, I mean, like, it is that incredibly tricky thing to predict in football. I'm sure you must have seen someone that you thought, well, he's of a level, and then a couple of years later you had egg on your face.
No, because I suppose I would put it back to my own situation. I developed late and I learned the game as well. So I would never write anybody off at any age. Everybody's capable. I mean, if you get to a certain level, to Basel or Chelsea, you clearly have something.
Sure.
I mean, you know, there's some level of talent, and somebody has seen something in you, especially to pay 11 million quid to get him from Basel. But then it's about developing it. It's not guaranteed. And many, many players do kind of change hands for money, and it never happens. But there's lots of players that develop late. Lots of players that you think aren't, you know, really very, you know, they have the attributes and they have all the ingredients, but they can't quite put it together. That's much more common. But if a player is switched on enough and is willing to learn and has a certain mentality, he absolutely can learn about how to get the best out of himself physically. He can learn tactically. But then, of course, he has to be put in the right system to suit him. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you took Mo Salah and put him in Man United's team, I think he probably would struggle as well. You know, standing out there on the wing on his own. I mean, he benefits from having Trent Alexander-Arnold. He benefits from being able to make these internal runs. He benefits from having Bobby Firmino go short, which takes two centre-backs two or three steps forward, creates those pockets of space. So Liverpool is a well-oiled machine, and they've bought certain type of players for a certain type of system, and it works.
Did you have a sudden spurt of development in your career, or was it always just pretty steady, improve year on year?
Yeah, it was just gradual, because I came up through the divisions, and I remember the start of every season when you gained a promotion, you realised you were going up a level and you needed to learn. And I always approached every season with a mentality of like, okay, this is new. And every game I played was pretty much, you know, okay, you've done okay today, but you've done X, Y, and Z good, but you've done A, B, and C wrong. And then you're trying to improve and learn and adjust. And then you're at an age where you're trying to have the confidence to say that you belong here. And then I just treated it the same way when we went in the Premier League the first year. I just thought, you know, it's a game-by-game basis, a half-by-half almost, where it's like, okay, you need to learn very, very quickly. And I did. And I had an open mind. I didn't arrive in the Premier League thinking that, you know, I'm the finished article and I'm good enough to be here. I knew I had to learn, and I had to learn very, very, very quickly. And a lot of the times, you know, the best way to learn is to make mistakes. But if you make mistakes, you're not going to be given the opportunity to learn, because you're not going to play. So a lot of the mistakes I was making, I not necessarily get punished for, but when I watched games back, I realized that, you know, if that midfield player had seen my positioning there, he could have picked me off. You know, it wasn't a great position. So that type of analysis, that type of, you know, it's easy to say that when I got caught for a goal, he should have done this, you know, he done this and he shouldn't have. But it's kind of the ones where you realize and you're really critical to the point of, I got away with that there. You know, that cross didn't come in, or that pass didn't get played there, but that's a really, really poor position. You know, you should be here. You know, that type of analysis and that level of learning. So that's what I was like. But Salah has obviously just gotten better and more confident year on year. And he has developed, no doubt.
No, he sure has. So you found being able to watch yourself on TV was a big help in your development.
Yeah, watching games back and remembering certain situations in games and kind of putting it in the back pocket for afterwards. You know, somebody would make a run and I'd get attracted, and then I'd kind of realise, oh God, you're out of position here. There's a hole somewhere. Maybe you shouldn't be here. But then the midfielder would check out and go somewhere else, and I'd kind of recover my position. But it was always like, okay, put that in the back pocket and watch that later. And I always remembered that. And then afterwards, I would kind of watch the games back and I'd realize, no, you were a bit critical on yourself there. You were right. Then there's other situations where I didn't realize it. So it was just that level of learning and positioning, and just ultra critical of every decision I made.
Yeah. I can see how for a defender, that kind of analysis is really helpful. I'd love to interview or hear Salah even asked if he used tape in the same way. Like, I'm not sure if, you know, the instinctive brilliance we saw for his goal, for instance, I don't know if that's honed by watching TV or himself back necessarily. I get it with positional play and should I track that runner or should I not, or how does that look on screen? But he's almost just blossomed in this like self-made way. I suspect, and who knows, but it's from working at it each day in training, getting a bit better and a bit better each day in training. That's how I think he would have done it over the last seven, 8 years.
And I think, listen, and it would be remiss not to mention, the system just suits him down to the ground. I mean, I can't say that enough. Like, I know a lot of people say he's a world-class player, but it fits him. It just, every attribute that he has is catered for in that system in Liverpool. And as I said earlier, you can take him out of that and put him somewhere else, and he might not be as effective because other teams might do something different. But the way Liverpool's set up, it's tailor-made for him. And, and that's why he's blossoming to the level that he's blossomed at as well. And I think he would do well to remember that when it comes time to move on, that maybe an extra bit of money to go somewhere else might not necessarily be worth it, because I'm pretty sure Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp, they're only going to get better and better.
No, screw you, dude. He's gone to Newcastle for $2 million a week and the training grounds in London, and that's just the way it's going to be. And he's going in January. By the way, before you go, other end of the spectrum to Salah's development is Wayne Rooney. There's a new Wayne Rooney documentary coming out on Amazon. I've no idea if it's meant to be good or not, but I suspect be watching it one way or another. He's such an interesting case study in that his numbers are off the charts in terms of number of games played, goals scored internationally at Manchester United, not least even at United, where he would be thrown out onto the left wing to do running that Ronaldo would not do for a period when Rooney was probably at the peak of his career. Phenomenal. Like, it's just phenomenal. And yet, I think the instinctive sense people would have of Rooney would be didn't fulfill the genius potential we saw from the 18, 19-year-old when he was almost on a par with Ronaldo. And the comparison Ronaldo probably hurts him because they were similar age, same team. One went stratospheric, all-time great. And I think at 18, 19, 20, there was probably a hope, certainly in English minds, that Rooney would be all-time great, you know, top 10 of all-time potential. So you would have come up against him, I'm sure. The Rooney one is, like I said, opposite end of the spectrum to Salah. And I suspect history will judge him incredibly well, but those who watched him come on the scene and play through his career, and they see the pictures of, you know, late nights out and maybe not looking after himself a touch, and you wonder what could have been. So your thoughts on Rooney?
I love him. I think he's one of the best that I've ever played against. He had everything, character, personality, skill, dogged, rough, hungry, aggressive, everything. He probably doesn't get the credit that Ronaldo gets because of the stuff you said. He has a list pretty long of indiscretions, and he wasn't as aesthetically pleasing as Ronaldo. A lot of his goals were just brute force. I mean, he was just such a physical guy, and that's probably why aesthetically he's just not as easy on the eye. But for me, I think he is one of the best, if not the best, in Premier League history. He really is. I mean, maybe the best is a bit of a stretch, but he's definitely top five greatest Premier League players of all time. He has everything, and I can't say enough about him. I think he's brilliant, and he's a tremendous fella as well. He was no difficulty insofar as to play against. You know, he wasn't one that would be mouthing off around that. He was quite, I won't say nice, but, you know, he was reasonable.
Yeah, respectful pro doing his
exactly.
Job.
Yeah.
I think he does get a hard deal because, again, I think of the Euros and how he burst on the scene, and it just seemed like the possibilities were endless. But it's so hard to live up to that potential. Jeez, I mean, like,
but he
was
did,
being called
though.
The what?
He did.
He did. I know, but he was being called the. And yet at the same time, there were periods in his career where, like, he was 30 and people were writing pieces saying, "What's happened, Rooney?" You know.
I disagree. Listen, his numbers stack up.
Sure.
You know, I think in time there probably will be a bit more praise for him.
Yeah.
Perhaps he might even get a statue somewhere. I mean, he's England's all-time leading goal scorer.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't win any major tournament with England. That'll probably stop him getting a statue. But I think at Manchester United, he should have something. You know, when you look at what Henry has done for Arsenal, he is a statue. But I do think Rooney has been a wonderful player. Maybe a statue at Man United might be a bit of a stretch, but
all-time scorer. Yeah,
that type of recognition. I mean, Man United have a litany of stars, I suppose, that kind of altered the course of the club. They're the ones that get the statues. But he definitely will be remembered very fondly from Manchester United point of view. And I think in time, once all the indiscretions are kind of forgotten about, he will be.
Yeah. No, totally. It's just an interesting one. I deliberately use the word, it's an instinctive kind of sense you'd have of Rooney, because I think when you give it a bit more thought, you have to kind of conclude, geez, I think the boy done good, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely fulfilled his potential, and that's all you can ask of anybody.
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. Time is pretty much against us. We are done. I was going to ask you about Stephen Kenny in Ireland, but we'll do that we hadn't really talked to you since last week, but we'll do that another time. There are big games, obviously, coming against Portugal and Luxembourg, so we'll do that in due course. In the meantime, great to get your thoughts and all that. Pleasure, Damien. We'll talk to you again soon. Cheers, my man. Thank you. That was Damien Delaney with us on the Football Show this evening, which was, of course, brought to you by Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.